Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Christopher Jones Cruz, Marcia James, and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will present a special Making of a Nation report on the attack on the United States base at Pearl Harbor during World War II. But first, here is Christopher Jones Cruz.
Immigration has been and continues to be a major issue in the United States. Immigration has been angrily debated during the 2016 presidential election campaign. It also is important in many state and local election races, such as the 6th Congressional District of Colorado. There, 20% of registered voters are Latino. VOA recently went to Denver, Colorado's capital, to examine the effect of the Latino vote on the election. Morgan Carroll is the Democratic candidate for Congress in the 6th District. Today, she is visiting a place that helps people who are living in the United States without legal permission. Some activists call such persons illegal aliens. Others call them undocumented immigrants.
Hi, Sarah.
Good to meet you.
Thank you for coming.
I think it's a microcosm for the world and for our country.
What you're showing is how strong the unmet need really is.
Morgan Carroll says voters tell her they oppose immigration laws that force some family members to leave the country but let others stay.
I hope they realize their own strength and numbers and the power they have, that this is the time to demand better policies and treatment for them, for their families.
The borders of the 6th Congressional District changed in 2011. The changes caused an increase in the number of Latino voters in the district. Carroll's opponent, Republican Mike Kaufman, currently represents the district in Congress. Many Republicans support strong immigration laws. But after the redistricting, Kaufman reduced his support for such laws. And he has been using advertisements to reach out to Latino voters.
Mike Kaufman is uno de nosotros.
Yo le hago frente.
Kaufman has worked to learn Spanish, and he has strongly criticized his party's presidential candidate, Donald Trump. The 6th Congressional District race is one of the closest in the country. But Latino voters are not only changing congressional races. Colorado is home to more than 500,000 Latinos who can vote. They have changed the state from one that usually voted for Republicans into a swing or battleground state, one that either major party has a chance to win. But Latinos will have power only if they vote. Activists say many Latinos register, but do not take part in elections. Dulce Sines is a Latino community organizer.
Oftentimes when in other countries you're not encouraged to vote or elections aren't free and fair, you wonder why maybe other immigrants that become newly registered or new citizens aren't voting. I think there might be some of those tendencies from other countries.
Jenny Santos goes from home to home in a Denver neighborhood 6 days a week.
So we just wanted to make sure that you're going to turn out to vote for our November 8th election.
Santos says she tells people why they should vote.
It's important for them to turn out to vote. Every vote counts, and their vote matters. Sometimes it's disheartening to hear that folks feel that our politicians aren't listening, our government is not listening.
But she says politicians also need to appeal to Latino voters.
If campaigns don't target the Latino community to get them out to vote, then folks will not turn out to vote.
Carol agrees.
They want to see that you're actually leading a fight to do something to help their families and that you're not just doing lip service in either English or Spanish.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
The World Health Organization says the widespread use of sugar in food products and drinks is a major concern in many areas. So WHO officials are calling on governments to require taxes on sugary drinks in an effort to limit their usage and popularity. The officials believe the taxes also would reduce the risk of health problems resulting from obesity. Obesity is a condition in which the body stores large, unhealthy amounts of fat. Obese individuals are considered overweight. A new report says that in 2014, more than one-third of the adults in the world were overweight, and 500 million were considered obese. The United Nations Agency estimates that in 2015, 42 million children under age 5 were either overweight or obese. It says that number represents an increase of about 11 million during the past 15 years. Almost half of these boys and girls live in Asia and one-fourth in Africa. The UN agency blames unhealthy diets for a rise in diabetes cases. There are 422 million cases of the disease worldwide. WHO says 1.5 million people die from it every year. It says the use of sugar in food products, like sugary drinks, is a major reason for the increase in rates of obesity and diabetes. Temo Vakanivulu is with the agency's Department for the Prevention on Non-Communicable Diseases. He told VOA that taxing sugary drinks would reduce consumption and save lives. Vakanivulu noted that Mexico enacted a 10% tax on sugary drinks in 2014. He said by the end of the year, there was a 6% drop in the consumption of such drinks. Among poor people, the number of people who consumed sugary drinks dropped by 17%. The WHO report says China has more obese people than any other country. 43 million men and 46 million women. The United States is home to almost 42 million obese men and 46 million women who are obese. The WHO says people should limit the amount of sugar they consume. It says they should keep their sugar intake to below 10% of their total energy needs and reduce it to less than 5% for improved health. It warns people to be careful in their calculations because sugar is everywhere. I'm Marcia James.
Scientists in Scotland are using modern technology to examine the bones of a large sea creature that lived 170 million years ago. First found 50 years ago in Scotland's Isle of Skye, the bones of the sea monster were trapped in hard rock until recently. Thanks to technology, scientists are finally able to separate the bones from the rock. What they discovered was a reptile that lived in the oceans at the time of the dinosaurs. Until now, this creature was unknown to researchers. Reptiles are cold-blooded animals. They produce eggs and have hard, flat scales covering the outside of the body. Examples of modern reptiles are snakes, turtles, and alligators. The scientists in Scotland are excited to see that the skeleton of the ancient reptile is almost complete. Stephen Broussardi is a paleontologist with the University of Edinburgh. He studies fossilized bones of ancient animals and plants. Now, he is studying the sea monster's fossils.
There's over 100 bones there, so a whole bunch of the skeleton. And now we get to get down to the fun business of actually studying it, figuring out what it is.
This is what the scientists already know. The sea monster was more than 4 meters long. They say it was from a class of ancient sea creatures called ichthyosaurs. Ichthyosaurs looked something like modern dolphins. They could swim fast. The ancient reptile fed on fish and other sea life, with its hundreds of cone-shaped teeth. The scientists hope that studying the bones will give them a better understanding about the reptile's ecosystem. The sea monster lived during the Earth's Middle Jurassic period. It lasted from about 160 million years ago to 180 million years ago. Only a few fossils have been discovered from that time, Broussardi explains, which makes this sea monster a great find.
It's one of the only good skeletons of one of these ocean reptiles from the middle part of the Jurassic period. This was a time that was a really interesting moment in evolution. You had all kinds of new groups of dinosaurs and ocean reptiles getting their start, starting to spread around the world.
The sea monster, like other ichthyosaurs, died out about 95 million years ago. That is, about 30 million years before the dinosaurs disappeared from the planet. Paleontologist Broussardi says changes in their watery environment means the monster did not die out suddenly, but slowly disappeared.
It looks like it was changes in the oceans, in the chemistry and in the ecology of the oceans. And so you had a long-term winnowing away of these ichthyosaurs as they became less and less common, less and less diverse, until they trickled away to extinction. And then that is when groups like sharks and ultimately whales and dolphins moved on in.
Sea monsters have been at the center of many stories people have told throughout history. In modern times, people tell the story of the Loch Ness Monster in Scotland. It is described as large in size, with a long neck, and one or more humps rising out of the water. But no one has ever proved it really exists. The sea monster being studied in Scotland does not come from someone's imagination, but in fact once lived in the water until it died and its bones became trapped in rock. In the future, its skeleton will be made available for people to see. I'm Ann Ball.
Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941 was one of the most successful surprise attacks in the history of modern warfare. Japanese warships crossed the Western Pacific to Hawaii without being seen. They attacked the large American naval and air base at Pearl Harbor on a quiet Sunday morning. Steve Ember has more.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war.
Many of the American military personnel were asleep or at church. They were totally unprepared for the attack. In fact, some people outside the base thought the Japanese planes must be new types of American aircraft on training flights. The sounds of guns and bombs soon showed how wrong they were. The Japanese planes sank or seriously damaged six powerful American battleships in just a few minutes. They killed more than 3,000 sailors. They destroyed or damaged half the American airplanes in Hawaii. American forces, caught by surprise, were unable to offer much of a fight. Japanese losses were very low. There was so much destruction at Pearl Harbor that officials in Washington did not immediately reveal the full details to the public. They were afraid that Americans might panic if they learned the truth about the loss of so much military power. The following day, President Franklin Roosevelt went to Congress to ask for a declaration of war against Japan.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. We will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
The Senate approved President Roosevelt's request without any opposition. In the House of Representatives, only one congressman objected to the declaration of war against Japan. Three days later, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. Congress reacted by declaring war on those two countries. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor ended the long American debate over whether to become involved in the Second World War. American politicians and citizens had argued for years about whether to remain neutral or to fight to help Britain and France and other friends. Japan's aggressive attack at Pearl Harbor united Americans in a common desire for military victory. It made Americans willing to do whatever was necessary to win the war. And it pushed America into a kind of world leadership that its people had never known before. President Roosevelt and his advisors had to make an important decision about how to fight the war. Would the United States fight Japan first, or Germany, or both at the same time? Japan's attack had brought America into the war, and it had severely damaged American military power. But Roosevelt decided not to strike back at Japan immediately. He would use most of his forces to fight Germany. There were several reasons for Roosevelt's decision. First, Germany already controlled much of Europe, as well as much of the Atlantic Ocean. Roosevelt considered this a direct threat, and he worried about possible German intervention in Latin America. Second, Germany was an advanced industrial nation. It had many scientists and engineers. Its factories were modern. Roosevelt was concerned that Germany might be able to develop deadly new weapons, such as an atomic bomb, if it was not stopped quickly. Third, Britain historically was one of America's closest allies, and the British people were united and fighting for their lives against Germany. This was not true in Asia. Japan's most important opponent was China. But China's fighting forces were weak and divided and could not offer strong opposition to the Japanese. Adolf Hitler's decision to break his non-aggression treaty with Soviet leader Joseph Stalin and attack the Soviet Union made Roosevelt's choice final. The American president recognized that the Germans would have to fight on two fronts, in the West against Britain and in the East against Russia. He decided it was best to attack Germany while its forces were divided. So the United States sent most of its troops and supplies to Britain to join the fight against Germany. American military leaders hoped to attack Germany quickly by launching an attack across the English Channel. Stalin also supported this plan. Soviet forces were suffering terrible losses from the Nazi attack and wanted the British and Americans to fight the Germans on the West. However, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and other leaders opposed launching an invasion across the English Channel too quickly. They worried that such an invasion might fail while the Germans were still so strong, and they knew this would mean disaster. For this reason, British and American forces decided instead to attack the Italian and German troops occupying North Africa. British forces had been fighting the Italians and Germans in North Africa since late 1940. They fought the Italians first in Egypt and Libya. British forces had successfully pushed the Italians across Libya. They killed more than 10,000 Italian troops and captured more than 130,000 prisoners. But the British success did not last long. Hitler sent one of his best commanders, General Erwin Rommel, to take command of the Italians. Rommel was brave and smart. He pushed the British back from Libya to the border with Egypt. And in a giant battle at Tobruk, he destroyed or captured more than 800 of Britain's 900 tanks. Rommel's progress threatened Egypt and the Suez Canal. So Britain and the United States moved quickly to send more troops and supplies to stop him. Slowly, British forces, led by General Bernard Montgomery, pushed Rommel and the Germans back to Tripoli in Libya. In November 1942, American and British forces, commanded by General Dwight Eisenhower, landed in Northwest Africa. They planned to attack Rommel from the west, while Montgomery attacked him from the east. But Rommel knew Eisenhower's troops had done little fighting before, so he attacked them quickly before they could launch their own attack. A major battle took place at Kasserin Pass in western Tunisia. American forces suffered heavy losses, but in the end, Rommel's attack failed. 3 months later, American forces joined with Montgomery's British troops to force the Germans in North Africa to surrender. The Battle of North Africa was over. The Allied forces of Britain and the United States had regained control of the southern Mediterranean Sea. They could now attack Hitler's forces in Europe from the south. The Allies wasted no time. They landed on the Italian island of Sicily in July of 1943. German tanks fought back, but the British and American forces moved ahead. Soon they captured Sicily's capital, Palermo, and within weeks they forced the German forces to leave Sicily for the Italian mainland. In late July, Italy's dictator, Benito Mussolini, was overthrown and placed in prison. The Germans rescued him and helped him establish a new government protected by German troops. But still, the Allies attacked. They crossed to the Italian mainland. The Germans fought hard, and for some time they prevented the Allied troops from breaking out of the coastal areas. The fighting grew bloodier. A fierce battle took place at Monte Cassino. Thousands of soldiers lost their lives. But slowly, the Allies advanced north through Italy. They captured Rome in June of 1944, and they forced the Germans back into the mountains of northern Italy. The Allies would not gain complete control of Italy until the end of the war, but they had succeeded in increasing their control of the Mediterranean and pushing back the Germans. One reason Hitler's forces were not stronger in Africa and Italy was because German armies also were fighting in Russia. That will be our story next week.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.